Hello all, it is I, Daisha. You know, I was super happy to hear from Richard Sherbo, who's one of the guests in this episode, because not only did Richard have a great idea for a show, which was to talk about the importance of new classical music in the context of, you know, like all classical music being new music once upon a time, Richard is also a Classical Classroom alum. He's actually been on the show twice. Once was to talk about storytelling with music, and another was to talk about classical music in cartoons, which is super fun. This time, though, he brought a friend with him. That's David Allen Miller, who's also in this episode. And, you know, sometimes there are episodes where I really feel like it's a lesson that we all need to learn, and so I try really hard to kind of like stick to a format in the conversation. But I love it when I'm doing that and guests like Richard and David, they kind of take my best laid plans that I have on paper and they just sort of turn them into origami. And it's way more interesting. And that's what they do in this episode, and I think you're gonna dig it. By the way, if you do dig it, make sure to subscribe to, rate, and review us wherever you listen. Okay, let's go. There's a rumor going around that classical music can be hoity-toity. But here in the Classical Classroom, we beg to differ.
Beethoven 5.
The idea that classical music is a zone where we have to feel restricted or we have to act in a certain way, you know, that's not going to be helpful going forward.
Isaiah is shaking with excitement. Oh, here.
I mean, there's just so many great parts of the opera.
He asked me to play his favorite spot in the first movement of the Brahms. And then he said, I started using those licks in my guitar solos.
How to be classical music rock stars, because there's not enough of that in this business.
Occasionally, I would plug in the mandolin to my distortion pedals.
I don't change my voice.
And talking to classical music voice.
I'm playing classical music now. I mean, it's the same 12 notes. That's what's so cool about it.
I'm Daisha Clay, a classical music newbie, and I'm trying to learn all I can about the music. Come learn with me and the classical music experts I invite into the Classical Classroom. Hello, everyone. I'm Daisha Clay, and welcome to the Classical Classroom. Today with me, I have Richard Sherbo, who is a veteran Classical Classroom guest. He's the director of the National Orchestral Institute, where, and I'll quote because it's true, he leads one of the nation's most prestigious training programs for young orchestral musicians. David Allen Miller is also with me today, and he is the music director of the Albany Symphony. He's a three-time Grammy nominee. I said granny nominee, Grammy nominee, and also a Grammy Award winner, with one of his nominations being very recent. It was for Best Orchestral Performance, and it was for a recording of a piece where he was guest conducting for the National Orchestral Institute. So Richard and David are here to teach me about why new music is so important to classical music's continuation, namely because it was all newfangled experimental music at one point. Guys, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Great. Thanks, Daisha.
So, Richard, talk to me a little bit about what the National Orchestral Institute does.
Sure. So we're in our 32nd year now, and essentially we are an orchestral summer camp for college-age musicians. We bring orchestral musicians ages 18 to 28 from all around the country to spend a week working with amazing guest conductors like David, who's here today with us, and also pair them with a cast of faculty, mentors, and coaches that come from all the major orchestras in the United States.
And I jump in and say that he makes it sound very modest, orchestral summer camp. It's really this incredibly high level, really professional level training for unbelievable young musicians. If you know about Tanglewood or Aspen or those programs, this is very much like that. These musicians are just incredible.
So there's not a lot, there aren't a lot of like wedgies or sitting around like a campfire singing
right.
Kumbaya.
It's no, more sadly, like, we're a little short on marshmallows.
But, no pool parties.
Yeah, unfortunately. But it's super fun because these people, I don't want to call them kids, these young musicians are so focused and serious, and they're so idealistic about wanting to make great music. It really sounds like one of the great major orchestras of the world by the time we get to concert time at the end of the week of rehearsals.
Well, I want to get back to that. But first, I think we have to get down to the business of you guys teaching me something, which is, you know, Richard, when was it in classical music history that everyone sort of collectively decided that all the music was written and that we could stop now? the canon had been it had been created, and there was no need to make any more music. When did that happen?
Well, I don't think that has happened completely. I think that institutions, orchestras as they are, have just become more and more conservative over the years, David's Orchestra being an example of one that's not going that way. But if you look at what orchestras like the New York Philharmonic and the National Symphony and others are doing, you see probably starting in the 80s or 70s.
1880s. I think it's in the 1880s.
That we just sort of became, reverent to these composers such as Brahms, Beethoven, and others. So, you see that the reverence maybe started with Stokowski. I read that he sort of made this experience of what an orchestra should be, and that it was very reverent to these composers. But, we still have composers living, and it's still important that we support them, and it's important that we train young people to be able to play that music, and that's what we're doing at NOI.
I have a different answer, actually. Yeah, can I give you my alternative answer? My answer is a man named Mr. Dwight, who lived in Boston in the 1870s, and he did an incredible disservice to American music, because he had this kind of idea that that everything should be judged in relation to Beethoven. He was a total Beethoven fanatic, and he had this incredible sort of reverence, as many Americans do, this idea that European culture was just far more evolved and important and valuable than American culture. And so he would always hold up any Boston concert in the 1860s, 70s, 80s to, well, is it as good as Beethoven? And so there was this whole kind of cult that got going of, like, if it isn't as good as Beethoven, why are we wasting our time on it? And to me, that was so destructive. And so you actually see in concert programs from the 1880s and 1890s this incredible shift from concerts that are mainly of living music to concerts of mainly dead composers. And I did a Mozart recreation concert, and we had somebody impersonate Mozart, and he came to our concert, and he was like, it's so great you're playing my music, but I'm dead. And I was like, well, now we mainly play dead composers. And he was aghast. He was like, you play music by dead composers? Why would you waste your time playing music by dead composers? In Mozart's time, they almost never played dead composers. That was considered an incredible rarity. Every composer was a creator, a performer, and he or she, like Mozart, would write a new piano concerto, and then it would be featured, and that's what people wanted to hear, the latest thing, just like films. I mean, it's nice to see old films, but mainly what people want to see is the latest thing.
Right. Yeah, it's kind of like in visual art. Of course, we revere the works of like your Rembrandts, your Van Goghs, and all of that kind of stuff. But there is a division, I think, like an analogous kind of division in the visual art world, where it's like, you've got your museum and then you've got your contemporary art museum. It treats it in like anything that's newly created is somehow separate from this thing called the canon, or the repertoire, whatever.
And I'm particularly sorry to say that in our field, in orchestra music, that has become completely the case, that it's really become this kind of museum culture. And that's what people like Richard and I are really fighting against. My orchestra in Albany, we do probably 60 or 70% living composers, living, breathing, particularly emerging composers who come and spend time with us. And we're playing premieres all the time. And to me, that's what keeps an art form vital, is new art created for that world. So I think a lot of the industry has really gone in completely the wrong direction for a long time. But I actually am very hopeful. I think it's really reversing and changing now. There's a lot more interest in emerging artists now. Yeah, so it's kind of an exciting time.
But I also think it's important to unpack why this sort of thing happens so that it doesn't happen again. So I want to spend a little bit of time analyzing what was behind this mindset. And I know you've mentioned a couple of important people. One was it Leon Stokowski, or was, I can't remember.
Leopold Stokowski.
Leopold.
Right, great conductor.
Isn't he the one that's often in the Bugs Bunny cartoons?
Well, he's in Fantasia.
His first moment, Fantasia.
He was the conductor for a long time of the Philadelphia Orchestra, and he was a great conductor. He was an American conductor, but he put on this sort of affected English accent, European accent, to seem foreign. But he was an incredible orchestral technician, and he actually was himself kind of a composer. He did all these amazing arrangements of Bach that are still played to this day, and he was kind of an orchestral magician. I don't know that he was such a conservative, but he certainly loved the traditional historical works.
Yeah, and I know that he was really instrumental in sort of shaping the concert experience that we have now. So the idea of having playing single movements or, clapping between movements, I mean, he really sort of solidified that this walking into the concert hall was a sort of reverential experience. I think he really played a big part in that.
Did a big disservice to all of us, yeah. Because I actually, if you go back to Beethoven, people actually treated orchestra concerts very much like jazz events today. You know, there are all these contemporary accounts of Beethoven symphonies where it says the second movement was such a success that they had to repeat it immediately. So that means that at the end of the second movement, people applauded the Seventh Symphony, and then they couldn't go on until they played it again. So we have this whole new kind of fake history idea that, you know, the symphony is sacred and you don't clap between movements. And that's just historically completely wrong. So in a way, this idea of innovation and of experimentation has sort of been moved away from, and we're really working to try to bring it back to that, to make it a real shocking experience every time you come to a concert.
It seems like classical music has a similar history to a lot of other institutions in the world and culture in general. Like, I think we have these periods of great development and progress, and then we have these periods of where the pendulum sort of like swings the other way.
Yeah, it's certainly true. And actually, I was talking to the musicians today, and because we're rehearsing a Walter Piston symphony. Walter Piston was a wonderful mid-20th century composer. He taught at Harvard for like 35 years, and he was, you know, a very classical, elegant, technically brilliant composer. His music, he actually played jazz in jazz bands and has a little bit of jazz inflection, but it's very kind of central. It isn't so American sounding, but it's quite lovely and beautiful. And I was talking to the students about how, you know, there was this real move in the 20th century in American music that grew out of Schoenberg and his school, you know, the 12-tone school, ultimately the 12-tone serial school, which was also called, ultimately became kind of an atonal school. And there were very celebrated composers like Elliot Carter and Milton Babbitt and Charles Warren, whose music, frankly, to be blunt, is more respected than performed because it's so austere and difficult and complex and mathematically complex. And that became kind of the dominant aesthetic in the late 20th century. And so all these wonderfully tonal romantic composers, name your favorite mid-century American composer, Peter Menon, Piston, Harris, Hanson, even people like Copland and Stravinsky started trying their hand in the 1950s at 12-tone technique because that was what was being, quote, taken seriously. And I think in a way, and not to make a negative judgment about the idea of using that language, because certainly Schoenberg and Berg and Webern's music is very beautiful, but that really didn't connect with audiences in that it's somewhat unintelligible to many listeners and hard to get. It's not based on keys and such that we're kind of used to and tonality. And so there was this real move away from that. And composers like Milton Babbitt wrote a famous essay called Who Cares If You Listen, where the idea was like, I'm going to write what I want to write, and if there's no audience for it, the audience be damned. And frankly, that did a lot of damage to people like us who are trying to sell audiences on coming to concerts. And what's happened really starting in the 80s, maybe even in the 70s and to the present, is that there was kind of a return to tonality and to a certain kind of romanticism, but it's really a sort of postmodern, you know, if you think of the minimalists or if you think of, you know, hyper-romantic composers, people like Michael Torkey, like Steve Reich, like Philip Glass, John Adams, there's a real turn to accessibility, and that's been very powerful. And so I think we're really now reaping the rewards of that. And the young composers I see are so connected to pop music and pop culture and to different trends in the larger world of commercial music that now those lines between, quote, classical and, quote, popular have really blurred. And so I think it's a very exciting time because music, good music is just good music now.
Yeah.
That's my short history of the last 50 years. There it is.
You know, it made me think of kind of just American culture in general. Like, I think about in the 50s, you know, there was this rise of artists and writers that were sort of more experimental, like the Beats. They gave rise to more hippie culture. And then things were kind of becoming progressively more open, more experimental, just kind of in all of the ways, in the arts, in the way that people thought. And then culture began to backpedal. And then we had the 80s and a lot of real bad clothes. And, and, you know, like things became much more conservative. It sounds kind of like classical music is kind of,
it's a little bit like that.
It's a little
bit like that. It's always a little bit dangerous to make, like I just did, too many sort of generalizations. Because on the one hand, there was
obviously
this
overly simplified. I mean, there's so much more going on. But
there certainly was this trend of the creators really separating from the performers. As I said, you know, it's like in the 19th century, all the creators were performers and they were always thinking about the public. And then over the 20th century, the creators and the performers got somewhat distanced from each other and the creators started because they were being neglected or criticized or not embraced, a lot of them became kind of belligerent about the world, the real world of music consumption. At the same time, there were wild experimentalists like John Cage, and you know, who I think actually is very similar musically to the Beats, in that he was doing just wild experimentation. So there was this really austere European postmodern kind of thing going on with Carter and Babbitt and others like that. While at the same time, there was this kind of great, as you say, hippie culture happening with people like Terry Riley, like Cage, really crazy, wonderful experimentalists. And then out of all of that foment sort of emerged kind of the new trends. And what's wonderful, like in popular music, the new trend is really kind of embrace everything, you know, world music, hip hop, whatever, the music of the street, whatever it is, whatever your interest is, you create art out of that. And that's a much more inclusive kind of celebratory aesthetic. And I must say what's so exciting, especially among the young composers, is they're all embracing that just as other music creators are. So it's, again, those lines are really blurring in wonderful ways now.
You know, I think that we have established that this idea that, that classical music is this austere situation where only music by dead people counts. We've established that that is just plain inaccurate. But I think I want to illustrate that all music was new music at one point by going back in time and listening to some stuff that maybe at its time was thought of as you know, crazy, but now we just accept it as something that orchestras all over the world play. So can you talk about maybe an example?
Sure. I mean, there's so many great examples of pieces that now have entered the standard canon that were once revolutionary. The first piece that comes to mind that's probably a little over 100 years old now is Stravinsky's The Rite of Spring, which was just such a piece of modernism when it was first performed in Paris, that it had the famous story of the, you know, the riots that happened at the premiere. So, I mean, that piece is now part of our standard canon and is performed, you know, hundreds of times annually.
I know just a little bit about the history of this piece. At least there's this story that you hear in the world of classical music where the first time this piece was played to an audience, there was a literal riot. I've actually heard that that story is untrue, but I think, you know, whether or not it's factual, it's still interesting.
It's pretty true.
Because it kind of talks about, you know?
It's pretty true. What may not be true is that they were also reacting to the dance, which was really very bizarre.
Right.
Yeah, Nijinsky was kind of crazy. And he
choreographed it. That was the choreographer.
And so, yeah. Okay. So the dance also, I think, added a great deal to the sense of craziness. But I do think that there were a lot of people who came, you know, what do they say? They came for blood. They came because they knew that Stravinsky was this radical guy, and they knew that rhythmically it was crazy, and they wanted to sabotage it. So I think the riot story is pretty true. There was a lot of craziness around the
premiere. There was at least a cultural riot happening.
Yeah, it was.
If
it was very
else.
Much a culture riot. Yeah.
What it like? It's so angular sounding. It's just got all of these. I don't know how else to say it. It's got a lot of pokey parts.
Well, it has that sort of tribalistic dance rhythms that come in, especially towards the end. But even from the opening movement, which we hear that the way that Stravinsky uses the bassoon in the opening and then the English horn. I mean, these were sounds that were just so, you know, different from what other composers had used at that time. And it really set the precedent for what was going to come later in the piece.
And also even the subject matter, the idea of a sacrificial virgin being sacrificed to the gods to appease them in spring was already kind of radical in the idea that they were setting that on the stage. I mean, Diaghilev, the impresario who created this Ballet Russe that premiered all these amazing pieces like The Rite of Spring, he really was out to shock, and he wanted to shock the Parisian public. But I think that Stravinsky's contribution is what you're talking about, this pokey, crazy, primordial sense of rhythm that no quote classical composer had ever really attempted before. There'd never been an approach to rhythm that was so raw and so primeval and so powerful as what Stravinsky harnessed, you know, sort of his Russian soul. He reached deep down into his Russian soul, and he was a great pianist, and he had this really percussive approach to piano playing, so he would pound these chords on the piano, and it's a kind of music that just didn't exist before that. It was quite shocking.
But even before that, you have composers, you know, one of the first great examples is Berlioz's Symphonie Fantastique, where he, for the first time, through the construct of a symphony, really tells the story of an artist that's on an opium high and represents that through the movements of this work. Wagner's operas, you know, were just completely changed what opera looked like, what opera sounded like, and the tonal language that he used.
I was just going to say, this was one of the really transformational works of the middle 19th century, because it sort of took harmony, took the idea of chords in a place that they'd never been. You know, prior to this, there was a real sense of organization of the tonic, the dominant, the subdominant, and Wagner just, through this extreme chromaticism, going by half steps, he created a world of kind of endless melody that he would put over these wild chords, and Tristan is one of the best examples of that. This prelude, where it just kind of wanders wanders away in a strange and unique way.
Yeah. Very bleak. So this Wagner that we've been hearing, at the time, how did audiences receive it?
Well, I can't say I know for sure, to be honest. Wagner was so... He had such conviction in the work that he was doing, and you know, there's so many stories about him being chased from country to country at different points of his life, and then you know, ultimately building his own opera house just to perform these works in a way that he saw and felt that they should be performed, and really account for the orchestra as he thought that it should be accounted for.
Yeah, I'm not sure about Tristan specifically, but I do know that, you know, in the mid 19th century, the great culture war in music was between the adherents of Brahms and the tradition of Brahms and the adherents of Wagner. Brahms represented, truthfully or not truthfully, he was extremely involved with music of the past. He was a real, just almost like a music historian, and knew all of Bach's work and Beethoven's work, etc., and really referenced that in a powerful way in, you know, 50 years after the fact or 100 years after the fact, whereas Wagner proudly called his music the music of the Zukunft, the music of the future. And there was this whole school around Wagner of Liszt and then later Strauss and Mahler and Bruckner and others who really embraced the Wagnerian aesthetic of music not looking backward but sort of expanding into new vistas. And even if you go forward and look at composers like the great French impressionist Debussy, you know, in a certain way, he even went further away from traditional tonal centers and tonal harmony and such than Wagner had. And I think he owes a great deal to the freeing influence of Wagner. So there was this really weird culture war that went on through the whole second half of the 19th century between the Brahmsians and the Wagnerians about whether music should be of the future or reference the past. And of course, there's no real correct answer to that. And obviously the greatest music can do both or either. But it was a very controversial kind of music at the time.
When you love someone, you should set them free. If they come back to you, then you should lay a gigantic guilt trip on them for having ever left in the first place. I'm pretty sure that's how the saying goes, but the rules are totally different with podcasts. If you love a podcast, you should consider giving it a gift. It's already free. That is some Yoda-level thinking, people. Be our Jedi Knights and make a one-time or recurring gift to the show at classicalclassroomshow.com. Just look for the little tip jar button. We promise to love you forever and to be super clingy. I assure you that this entire thing made sense. I should know. I'm a medical doctor. By the way, if you love us, you'll also love the peeps who made our website, New Y. They can make a website for you too, and they can help promote your business. Check them out at classicalclassroomshow.com/NW. That's N as in new and W as in Y. And now back to my conversation with Richard Sherbo and David Allen Miller. Let's fast forward a little bit to some music of today that's a little closer to also you guys can stop me if you think there are important pieces between Stravinsky and today that we needed to talk about.
Sure, I think you know there's certainly a lot that happened in the 20th century. I think that skipping forward closer to today, some of the things that came out of the minimalist movement. I mean, some of John Adams' first big works, Harmony Lyra, is just an amazing orchestral piece that, again, for me, is a shocking piece that really that really set the orchestra apart differently.
Well, that's the funny thing that happened in like the 80s. It's like the return to tonality, to music that referenced the past, that the pre-modern past, you know, whether it was referencing classical style, Mozart, Haydn, Beethoven, or whether it was referencing the high romantic period. I'm thinking of like David Del Tredici's Alice in Wonderland pieces from the 70s. I mean, when tonality and traditional harmony and melody were reintroduced, that was viewed as shocking in the 1980s and the 1970s. It was like they thought music was going to go, you know, weirder and weirder out and away into these atonal worlds. And this sort of just brought the whole thing back into a connection to the grand tradition. So I think in a way that return to tonality, whatever it was kind of shocking in the evolution of concert music, of orchestral music.
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah. So it's like we went kind of in an experimental crazy direction, and then it actually became experimental and crazy to play more.
Right. It's like the universe was expanding, and then it turned out the universe stopped expanding and started doing, you know, started contracting. So it was kind of shocking. I remember there was a festival at the New York Philharmonic in the 1970s, I think, that Jacob Drugman, great composer at the time, curated. And it was called New Horizons, the New Romanticism. And when everybody heard the New Romanticism, they were outraged. It's like, there's no Romanticism. Romanticism died 100 years ago. But it really was this harbinger of the 80s, 90s, and particularly the present, that composers were once again embracing a lot of the aesthetics of the 19th century in particular.
Yeah. Let's talk about some living composers who you guys think are embodying whatever the magic thing is that makes a piece stay. Like, what, you know, and I don't know what, I feel like that's a whole other episode. Like, what is it that makes Rite of Spring stay? What is it that makes Debussy's piece stay? We could go on about that for days, but whatever it is, what are some pieces that you think future generations are still going to be listening to that are being made today?
Wow, great question. I'm going to be a little selfish and plug some of the music that we have done at NOI and with David over the last few years, because I think some of these have been great works that deserve to be recorded and deserve to be listened to more broadly. A composer who David has worked with closely for a long time and whose music is really important to America is John Corigliano. And the first album that we did with David was recording Corigliano's first symphony. David knows this piece intimately. He's conducted it many times, so I'll let him talk about sort of the craft and construction of it. But I think that's one of the things that makes a piece stay in the canon, is the sort of the craft, the construction, the way the emotional content of this work in particular is just overwhelming and still powerful today.
You know, so interesting. That's a great example, because that work, the Symphony Number 1, the so-called AIDS Symphony, which he wrote in the late 80s, the New York Philharmonic just like last week or a week or two ago performed it. And I read the review in the Times, and the review was, it was Tony Tomasini, the head critic, and he said something about, you know, when this piece came out in the 80s, I kind of recoiled at it. I was worried it was too overt and too obvious and too cloying or overly romantic. And he said, and now hearing it with fresh ears, 30-some years later, it's shockingly fresh, or 20-some years later, 30 years old. It's shockingly fresh and powerful, and all those concerns I had have sort of evaporated. And that's, I think, the sign of a great work. So that's a work, and John Corigliano is one of these deep, you know, he's the one who's really worked in film. He wrote the, he won the Academy Award.
Oh, that's where I know his name from.
The Red Violin, and he wrote the music for Altered States, and he's had a sort of sideline as a great film composer, but he's really principally a classical composer and has written just magnificent pieces, of which this is one of the most magnificent. And so that's a piece that I think Richard's right is really going to stick around. I have to say, though, I don't really worry about it. I'm not sure that art has to be judged on, will this be a timeless masterpiece? I think that's part of where we started our discussion. It's like, if all we worry about is what will be a timeless masterpiece, then no composer will ever put pen to paper or hands to computer keyboard or whatever it is they do, because they'll all be, it'll be so daunting. It's just that whole thing about, like, if it isn't as good as Beethoven, why are we bothering? That's just not the right question to ask. The question is, like, what can I say that's meaningful and powerful about our time and place? And my sense is about the composers today, whoever they may be, if their music really occupies a valuable, powerful space, it will endure. We had an interesting experience in my home orchestra in Albany a couple weeks ago. We did a premiere, we did a recording premiere of a very early piece by this David Del Tredici, who spent about 20 years in the 60s and 70s, really 80s, writing these gigantic, extravagant pieces inspired by Alice in Wonderland. And we did the very first one, which Pop Puri it's called, with a, it has like a rock band inside the orchestra and a screaming soprano and a chorus that intones Bach chorales. And it was just a lunatic piece from 1968. Never been recorded. And I have to say that approaching it in 2019, it had such a freshness and power because it so powerfully evoked the 1960s and the craziness of the 60s in this incredible artistic way. Who would have guessed in 1968 that it would have the power to do that? It's only looking back from many years later that one understands how powerful a work of art is. So I don't think we're really in the business of saying, this one is a masterpiece, that one's not a masterpiece. Throw this one in the garbage, keep this one for posterity. It's not our place to do. I just think our place is to champion as much great music as we can champion and encourage as many composers to create works as we can.
And I completely agree with you. I think that approaching either the creation of art or the championing of art from the perspective of, will this be around, you know, many
years? Who cares?
Years?
Who cares? I don't care. Exactly. We'll be dead. Why do we care?
I totally agree with you. However, there is, I think, something that makes particular music, particular art, stick in the sort of collective cultural brain, it plays out in really practical ways. Like, it's the stuff that orchestras keep playing. It becomes like known pieces. I don't think that's something that you can probably create on purpose. But I think it is a curious question. Like.
I would say it's even more subtle than what you're describing. I just know that, like, when you read history of music in particular, like Sibelius, great Finnish composer. Well, in the 1920s, for whatever reason, shortly, he was still alive, actually, Sibelius' music went wildly out of fashion. Nobody played it. Nobody considered it. And then, you know, 50 years later, it was all rediscovered, and now it's complete standard repertoire. But it was already forgotten. Mahler, similar example, kind of forgotten after his death, and then Bernstein and others created the whole Mahler revival. I was struck by this because I was doing a concert in Hudson, New York last weekend, and I was driving down from my home in Albany, and I was looking up as I crossed the Rip Van Winkle Bridge, and there was Frederick Church's beautiful home, Olana, which is this incredible late 19th century, incredibly indulgent castle that he built. You know, Frederick Church was one of the great Hudson River painters. And what's so sad when you go visit Olana is Frederick Church was the most famous painter in the world for about 10 years. And by the time you get through the house, at the end of the house, like, his most famous painting that people lined up around the block in New York City to view is like stuck on some dark wall because it now has no value because nobody wants it, which is not entirely true because now people collect the Hudson River School. But it's amazing to see how artists' fortune rise and fall, not necessarily even dependent on the quality of their work, but on the way taste changes and people's priorities change and the world's view of things changes. So I think it's very hard and a completely futile exercise. What I'm looking for is music that will be powerful to the people who are showing up Saturday night for the concert. That's what I care about.
Yeah.
And that will be powerful. Yeah.
That kind of brings us full circle to what you guys do. Like, the reason that this music continues to be played, the reason that pieces that are being created now will continue to be played, is because music directors and orchestras they choose to play them over and over, and then other groups do, and then all of a sudden there's a critical mass of people playing them, and then I think, you know, that's how it happens.
Right, and it's true in literature. You think of novels. Why do 92% of novels or 92% of new films not catch on? And then that 8% just catches on and everybody reads it and everybody wants to know about it and goes to see it. It's a real puzzlement. I mean, if Hollywood had figured it out, they would, you know, I always ponder how like great directors and great actors, you know, they should have the capacity to make great film after great film, but almost none of them can. It's very hit or miss, very challenging with art.
So, Richard, Before we close our discussion here, why don't you talk about one more piece of music, something recent that you just really dig, that you're playing right now, that the National Orchestral Institute is playing.
Yeah, so I have a great story that I'd love to share with you, and it relates to one of the pieces that we did with David a number of years ago. I was absolutely struck by the music of Michael Torkey when I was in high school, actually. I would go to the library and check out CDs, and all of the popular works were already checked out, all the Beethoven symphonies. So I was always bringing home albums like a complete set of Ives symphonies, and here's an album of music by Michael Torkey. And so when David and I began working together and thinking about what album we wanted to put together for our Naxos recording, I suggested this piece of music I'd been in love with for a long time, Michael Torkey's Bright Blue music. And David responded so enthusiastically and said, that's a great piece, I'd love to do it. And I have to admit, and I shared the story with David yesterday, but it wasn't until the parts arrived in our office and I looked at the dedication of the score, and David had commissioned Michael Torkey earlier, one of your first orchestras, probably the New York Youth Symphony. And so it was really special to be able to have David there as the commissioner and really bring this piece to NOI that year.
And it was actually Michael's second orchestral piece. I think he was 24 or 26 or something. And he'd written one piece that had been played by the New York Philharmonic, Ecstatic Orange. And then he wrote this piece. And it was written for my New York Youth Symphony at the time. And it was really hard. The youth orchestra could barely play it. But it was so beautiful. It was in D major. It was very post-modernist because it was really tonal and happy and beautiful. And it's just a lovely, lovely piece. Beautiful piece.
You guys, this has been such a great talk. I feel like I have a much greater understanding of this idea now. Like it kind of doesn't matter, does it? But only in hindsight.
I hope it doesn't matter. I mean, what matters is making beautiful art, and posterity is posterity. And if you get, I don't do creative. I'm a conductor. I'm the handmaiden. I'm the co-pilot of all these great creative artists. But I think if I were a creative artist, if I had to be thinking about posterity all the time, it would be paralyzing. I would want to create some beautiful, powerful, meaningful art for my time. And if it survives, great. And if it doesn't survive, well, you know, ultimately nothing is going to survive of our cultures. So the main thing is to give creative artists the space to create beautiful art, and then let the wind take it wherever it will.
Well, Richard Sherbo and David Ellenmiller, thank you so much for being on the Classical Classroom today. This was great.
Thank you. It was fun being with you.
Thanks, Stacia. Great to be back.
All right, everyone, that does it for this episode of Classical Classroom. For more Classroom, go to classicalclassroomshow.com. Listen, click, follow, message. You got this. You can subscribe to, rate, and review us wherever you listen if you would like to do us a solid, and I know you would. And now, listeners, a very special segment of the podcast that we like to call our Heroes section. Yes, these are listeners who have gone online and have given a financial gift to the program.
You're simply the best. Better than all the rest.
Thank you to Robert Goldstein, Sarah Fishman, Aaron Dent, Dave and Jan, Sergio Ocampo, Brian Colon, Page Flip, Sarah D., Bum Choi, Jeff Fine, Chad Rustin. And if I somehow overlooked your name in this or previous episodes, feel free to throw things at me. But know that I love you. If you too would like to be sung at like this, just go to our website, find a little button that says tip jar, and make a little donation. And this can happen to you too. Thanks today to the home of Classical Classroom, King FM, where we are finally on top of the dishes and laundry, and as long as we never eat or change clothes again, we are golden. Thanks to the birthplace of Classical Classroom, Houston Public Media. Thanks to our official existentially troubled donut shop, Don's Donuts, where we've got a hole right in the center of our being. Thanks to Richard Sherbo and David Allen Miller for being on the show. Thanks to me for saying words, but most of all, thanks to you for listening. We'll catch you next time.